Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Grant Newsham joining us now. Oh, I gotta turn the music off because it confuses Grant.
Yeah.
Newsham McNamara, over.
Yeah, hi.
Welcome to the third year, the beginning of the third year of All Marine Radio. How about that? Hello? Newsham! That didn't work out so hot. Let's call him. You would think that Skype would get a better... Hello? Earth to Newsham. Oh. Earth to Newsham. Maybe he can't hear me. Why would he not be able to hear you, Mac? Because your computer rebooted, and no, that's right. Ruh-roh. All right, stand by. That's right. And that's right. See, sometimes when your computer reboots relative to the sound card, it may make modifications. So then all of a sudden I had to reboot my computer over the weekend. So, but the sound card for Skype is good. So I'm not understanding why Newsham can't hear me. There's a report from the Associated Press. In the latest twist in the drama-filled nuclear talks with North Korea's Kim Jong-un, President Donald Trump announced on the eve of the historic meeting that he will be leaving Singapore early because the nuclear negotiations have moved more quickly than expected. That was before the two men even met, and it was not clear whether it was good news or bad news. No details were given. Interesting. Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, had seemed... All right, we'll try Grant one more time. To lower expectations. Newsham, McNamara, can you hear me?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, all right, well... We were having some issues. The Associated Press is reporting that the President of the United States will leave Singapore early and that negotiations are moving along quickly, and then the Secretary of State seemed to attempt to lower expectations. News is already happening. First of all, what do you think will come out of this?
The short answer is I don't know. I don't think that the meeting is going to end in a resolution of anything much. My guess is the North Koreans are not going to come up with a big offer of concessions that wows us.
This is what everything in post-Korean conflict has pointed to. This moment when the, what do we call Kim? What, does he have a title?
I don't know. Kim seems to be what he gets usually called.
Right. I was thinking about that. Yeah. Chairman Kim, that was Mao. Dictator Kim has, even though it might be factually correct, it has a little bit of an editorial content. So let's try not to use that as we're all trying to be nice. But I'm thinking, like, what is Leader Kim? I don't know what it is. But anyway, since post-Korean conflict, you know, they created a conventional the Koreans screwed by virtue of where their capital is. And so the North Koreans created a conventional threat that rivaled a nuclear weapon and then have built upon that for years and years and years and years to, in their eyes, maintain their own security. And then they begin to develop nuclear weapons, all pointing to the continuation of their dictatorship. Because they know losing dictatorships, they've watched Saddam Hussein, not so good. Muammar Gaddafi, not so good. So maintaining the dictatorship is pretty key to harmony within the family. And so that's important. And so we have this moment that we've angled for low 70 years. And now, how does it play out?
I don't know. I guess my guess is they're going to maybe some sort of a general statement about ending the war and cooperating and then talking some more. I have a feeling that Mr. Trump might be, his contact with Kim might be fairly limited lengthwise. You know, I'd be a little surprised if they decided they like each other so much or whatever reason they want to keep sort of extend the talks.
And like,
that can get kind of risky for Mr. Trump, but let's say the longer he's in there with Kim and doesn't get anything, sometimes easier to just go in for a short thing and quit while you're ahead and then let others try and work something out. But as I say, it's hard for me, you know, it is really interesting to say the least, but it's just hard to see this ending up like by noon today as having fixed everything. Or even with anything what I would call jaw dropping. You know, I'm willing to be proven wrong. I didn't think the Capitals would win, but you never know.
Well, hold on. Let's talk about that. That had to rock your world, okay? Alexander Ovechkin, right? A lifelong bridesmaid. He was not even the bridesmaid. He was like, he wasn't even the maid of honor. He was like one of the He was like one of the other maids, just a bridesmaid. Did that rock your Washington, D.C., maybe there's hope, little engine that could world?
No, you see, when you've been like a loser for 50-plus years, you're kind of used to it. So this is just sort of tapping on the armor a little bit. It was very nice.
All right.
It'll take more than this. Redskins and the Wizards in the same year would probably.
Wait, what about the Senators, okay? What about the Senators? I'm sure Bryce Harper was rooting against you. He's a Las Vegas native and said that he doesn't get nearly as nervous playing as he does when he watches his Knights play. So maybe he's inspired by it. So maybe the world is changing, and it'll start in D.C. with the Caps winning. It'll spread to these negotiations. So if I listen to you, you're lowering expectations as well. Then if I was looking at the president leaving early, he would leave early because that would send the message that, yeah, we're not getting so much here. I'm not going to remain here. And essentially dignify this and elevate this when what we're going to get out of this clearly is going to be not so much as you are kind of discussing.
Well, you know, that is not a bad negotiating ploy. And the tendency, particularly for Americans, is to always want to keep talking. You know how there's the businessman, the salesman who thinks, man, if I can just get him talking, keep him talking, I can work something out, I can win. And that's usually not the case, or often not the case, and it's never the case with the North Koreans, but you always see how Americans, diplomats, etc., go to the last mile, keep trying to just keep the other guy at the table, and sometimes a short exposure isn't a bad strategy if you've gotten this far. Time will tell, and it's not much time either. I doubt a coincidence that he just suddenly decided he was going to leave early. This was probably, he's probably leaving right on schedule, but just didn't announce it until recently. So that would be my guess.
So give me North Korea's strategy that's going to be exposed is going to be what? I mean, because I could see, okay, we're going to do something that at least dignifies the reason the president needs at least to be able to show that there was a good reason that he went there. So ending the Korean War would be a start. Okay. The next phase is we talk about total denuclearization, and with that would come there's pieces of that, and I want to know what you think about this. This is McNamara's thoughts. So in the process of total denuke, we say that. They say, okay, we want you off the peninsula. And we say, okay, then you have to withdraw your conventional forces beyond the range of your longest artillery piece. You have to pull them back. And so when Seoul's no longer threatened, we will feel like we can go ahead and remove significant numbers of our forces from the peninsula. What do you think of that kind of phased? So we end the Korean War, we begin a phase of economic exchange and development, and then we begin to discuss a phased denuclearization of North Korea. Is that McNamara's pipe dream, or do you think something like that could ever happen?
Could. I'd say especially if the Chinese weren't around. Because China is always able to, just by sort of turning on the taps a little bit, to give North Korea a reason to think they don't need to make any real concessions, that they don't need to change their long-term goal of taking South Korea. What you described is plausible, and the nature of the Kim regime is what, just as we've talked about many times before, is just this murderous group that maintains power through use of violence. And until that changes, it's hard to see sort of any changes that aren't purely tactical.
What are indicators of change? Because to me, if I subscribe to the little engine that could theory, mm-hmm. and I hear the voices of the hummingbird people, and the argument goes something like this: okay, he's Swiss educated, okay, he's a Western kid thrown back in his own gulag. Okay, as he rolls around the country and he sees their agricultural products fertilized with human feces, he knows that his nation is the one of the most destitute on the planet, and he wants to improve that. The Chinese have been content to keep him in that state. So it's not like they're doing him any grand favors other than keeping him supplied with the trinkets that keep him in power. I want more than that. He wants more than that. And so there is a natural inclination for this Western kid inside of his own gulag to seek to make it better. And so if we subscribe to that, and that's a big if, and I'm not saying you do, what would we see? What would we see? All right, short of him giving up, his sending his nuclear weapons to Tennessee tomorrow. What would we see? What would be the intermediate steps?
To me, I think it would be a little more freedom for his people. Some evidence that he's going to stop killing all but, you know, that million people who are in his inner circle. So a little more freedom. And that is could be opening up the gulags, closing them down, relaxing say restrictions on movement, formally relaxing sort of some of the economic incentives so that people can go in business for themselves legally, give them title to some of their land. This is sort of what Deng Xiaoping did in China. When was that? The early 80s, when they were trying to do kind of what Kim is doing to recover from this just disaster of Mao Zedong. And they really centered on giving the citizenry, say, a little more freedom. And once you do that, the nature of the regime has to change. In China's case, it's definitely changed, but it sort of hasn't changed entirely for the better, to say the least.
Right.
But to me, that's the thing Kim could do, more than any promise to sort of stop testing, stop developing weapons. It'd be nice if at the same time, as you noted, he moved his artillery away from Seoul, moved his conventional weapons back.
Right.
But to me, it ultimately opened a little more, relaxing this actually stranglehold he's got on the Korean people's throat, even by a degree, and would be, to me, that would be a sign that something's really different, because that would suggest a change in the nature of the regime to a degree. I don't think he's going to give up power anytime. But this has got to be, it's as repressive as Albania was, if not more so. And something along those lines is what would get my attention, rather than what I think he may make some sort of attractive sounding offers or alluring statements in Singapore. But those, in some ways, I suspect they'll be kind of vague. But also there may be an idea, an intention of getting the South Koreans sort of excited about it more than the Americans. And if the South Koreans get excited by what the North offers and the Americans are skeptical, that tends to create some friction between the Americans and the South Koreans, who are the ones in power now are a pretty left-wing bunch in many respects, anti-American in some respects. And if you can create some friction there, that would be a positive for Kim.
Okay, so now I want you to be Kim, okay? We're going to give you, you're going to be Kim Jong-Newsom, okay? And so if you were him, what would you do? I mean, because rule one of dictatorships is sustain power at all costs. Rule two is refer to rule one in all other cases. So those are Vito Corleone rules, by the way, also. So when you say loosen the reins of power, or we talk human rights, we're talking about the destabilization of his government. So if you were him, I have a stranglehold. He just replaced that in, okay, before we get to you being Kim Jong-Newsom, all right, tell me about replacing, because part of the question I was going to link it to is he just replaced the top three officers in his military. Tell me about that.
Well, once again, it's nobody quite knows. This is all you'll notice the commentariat. There's been a lot of press written about it. Nobody quite knows the significance of that. I do think that he is very uncertain of the loyalty of the military, and my guess is that it has more to do with just keeping them worried rather than putting in some really nice guys. So keeping them all worried would be my guess. That would be the safe estimate. The more liberal one, or the more assertive one, would be that he's actually found some guys who kind of share his vision of transforming North Korea into something less than a hellhole. From his perspective, and I think he's certainly aware of the model, is that it's worth considering that while China has certainly eased up in terms of sort of the basic freedom of its citizenry up to a point over the last 30, 40 years, it still has an iron grip on the country. And that's what I think he may be going at would be for his ideal, is to somehow get the benefit, the economic benefits and relative prosperity of relaxing the controls on the economy and allowing some freedom there, while at the same time making sure there is no opportunity for political challenge or political freedom. I remember some years back, that Lee of Singapore, former president, prime minister?
So confusing.
Mr. Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore went up. The Chinese invited him to go visit. It was the Vietnamese invited him to go visit. This would have been in the 90s. Because they wanted to know how you run a government, how you run a country that's successful economically but has no political freedom. And that's a bit of an exaggeration, but at the same time, you get the point, is that it's the Chinese have shown that in particular that it is possible to, and the Singaporeans to a much, much lesser degree, because it is a free place, but the Chinese in particular have shown that you can have economic opening up, be very successful without any political opening up, political freedom. And that may be, for Kim, a fairly attractive model, because you get to stay in power just like the Chinese Communist Party does. Your economy gets better, which makes you stronger militarily, both versus South Korea, but also versus China. And it also makes you less vulnerable to this American maximum pressure. So that might be, if I was Kim, that's maybe what I would be angling for.
All right, so that would be your take as Kim Jong Newsom. The so if I could dumb that down for the rest of us, we can still do everything we need to do, but we don't have to roll Flintstone style. We could evolve this thing into maybe a early 20th century model, or maybe even a late 20th century model. Retain all the control that we need to retain in order to sustain the family business, and yet everybody's boat rises. So okay, so if we look at that, let's just assume that Kim Jong Newsom, that's his model. What does he do with the United States? What does he do with the nukes? Because part of going from Flintstones to the 1960s is going to be, I've got to do this dance with the Americans, because this guy's locked in on our nuclear weapons. And as I'm trying to get us to the 1960s, I don't need to go to war, and a war that I will certainly lose. Do I dangle things? Do I make this thing into a really long negotiation? What would your strategy be, Mr. Kim?
I haven't had much practice at being this kind of a dictator lately.
I don't know. We have to talk to your kids about that.
I would try to keep stringing the Americans along as long as I possibly could. And, you know, I don't like to say that, really, because I do wish there was a way that something could change for the better. But I think in a Kim kind of way, in the Asian kind of way, particularly Koreans and Chinese, you humor the white man, humor the Westerners, give them, you act like your friends and act like you're offering all sorts of things and anything's possible, anything's on the table. You have them go away happy, thinking that just with one more talks, a few more talks, you can work something out, that a page has been turned in the relationship. And hopefully this administration is going to focus on, well, what has he offered to do in concrete terms? I hope they're talking to Dennis Rodman a lot, because he probably has the best insights into Kim as anybody. And I suspect they are. But at least you try to keep the other side thinking that you're going to you're their friend, that you're going to cooperate with them, that you really want to have a good relationship. And the more time you have, the time is on, in some ways, it's on Kim's side, partly because the South Koreans get antsy, the Chinese even up what they're going to offer him as well, in order just to keep the Americans from looking too good or having too good a time. I would try to play for time and have the Americans think that I'm a different guy. I'm going to do things differently, and maybe even make some concessions somewhere, but be ready to carry out the ultimate objective. Have that in mind.
What's the ultimate objective? Because here's what I'm thinking is as Kim Jong-un is that this Trump thing, I need Obama back in power, okay? Mm-hmm. Trump is surrounded. He's got Mattis, he's got Bolton, he's got Pompeo. This is like the axis of evil relative to my program, because they tend not to buy the smoke that I put out. They tend to be pretty direct, and they're pretty confrontational, and I don't need that. And so what would be reasonable that I might have to bargain away, Grant, that I would be comfortable bargaining away to buy time, to the next election? Because the next election, I may get a more friendly American administration. Hopefully I will. And then I can play the game again, because others have not played the game the way Mr. Trump is. So what would that bargaining tool be? What would that bargaining chip be?
Well, maybe just announce, one possibility, announce that you're going to put a complete permanent freeze on testing,
okay.
Say nuclear testing, missile testing. You won't shoot any missiles towards Japan or something like that.
So what I would do is I would create an agreement to do the things that I can't really do right now anyway, because I can't really test. I can't do nuclear tests because I imploded my mountain, and it's going to take us a while to make a new one. Okay, so I can test my missiles without shooting them over Japan. I just did that to tweak their nose. So I'm not giving away anything in either one of those things. So, yeah, I'm more than happy to do that. So is that the trick, give away things?
I would be inclined to do that, partly because if you do, you're going to have this chattering class or these of whatever, or people who think a deal can be reached, people who hate Donald Trump,
right.
People who hate America, who will say, well, look, he's cooperating, America, you can't go to war. You can't, it would be unfair, it would be impolite, just wrong for you to attack North Korea, use force. In fact, you should even ease up on the sanctions, because he's made a show of good faith. What have you done, America?
Right.
And really, if he can, you never know what's going to happen in November, or even 2 years from now. And I think if it turns out someone else or the Democrats get in, then by definition, it's probably better for Kim. And that, you don't really have to play for all that much time. If somehow there is this red wave and Mr. Trump has 6 more years, then he's got a bigger problem. But for now, see how it goes, in November, see how, the next two years play out. Obviously, that would be one way to play it, because once it looks like Kim wants to make a deal, wants to be concessionary, be nice. You think of all the commentary, what's going to sort of serve as sort of a gravitational force to keep Mr. Trump from using force, to keep America from pressuring North Korea as fully as they can.
And the whole time, I will have given up nothing.
Not really. Yeah, you know, it's nothing you can't afford not to give up.
Right.
But nothing you can afford to give up.
So a strategy would be to play that into the next election, so we slow roll it and we negotiate these items. And the first thing would be the cessation of the Korean War. The second thing would be economic cooperation. Then we would begin to negotiate the conventional pullback of forces. And then we would begin, and that is all going to take. And so then if we get to the next election and I've got my economy doing things that I want it to do, then I can begin to even slower roll a new administration. And they're not as unreasonable as Mr. Trump is. And as you say, all that beautiful music that's coming out of past concessions is going to be the basis for me not giving up anything. Because now I can play them for the fools that they are and essentially, you know, do what my father did, do what the Chinese have done forever.
That's one way to look at it. And I think it's a fair way to look at it. Plus, you continue the subversion of South Korea, and it's once, and I've noted before, but it is important to remember that South Korea really has a large part of sort of its elite or the intellectual class that really sees America as the problem. Even in parts of the populace in general, that's a view as well. But it's not universal. Like any society, it's complex. But it, just as we have huge numbers of people who despise Donald Trump, they're just insane over this. We have many people who don't. And South Korea is just
very. That's an insult to every insane person out there, Erica. Just so you know.
Oh, guys.
The level of craziness. I think it is beyond insanity. It is when something he says has merit, it cannot not even be considered for discussion because of the hysteria. It's quite frankly, it's amazing.
I think you're right. Yeah. But my point was that
I just wanted to give you apologize to all the insane people that are listening for lumping them in. With that other group. So
yeah, this is a different form. It's an extreme variation on insanity. But the point is that South Korea, there's lots of room for subversion, and it's been going on for a long time, and you see it with the Moon regime or Moon administration. And so you play that into the mix as well, and you know they're going to see, well, look, Kim wants to be nice. He's trying to cooperate. And look, these Americans – as we've been saying, it's the Americans who keep the Koreans from demonstrating fraternal brotherhood and love. And that's, you know, we may laugh at it, but if that's what you want to believe, that's a pretty powerful bit of evidence before your eyes.
Okay, so then I could, if I can affect some permutation of that and begin to navigate my country into the 1960s, then that would be a win for me. I haven't given up my nuclear weapons. I've got us from the Flintstone age to the 60s, and everybody's happy.
Yes, you know, that's not a bad outcome. And once again, as I say, it's useful to remember China's experience, which was not entirely, was not dissimilar. Whereas with Deng, when they did open up in the early 80s, that really was just like a rope around somebody's neck and it was really tight, and they were starved, they were dying, and if you just eased up enough to let them breathe pretty easily, that would seem pretty nice. And that's when China started to recover economically. It's never recovered politically, but economically it did. Right. And I think that, to me, is a if I'm in Kim's shoes, that's a pretty good. A pretty good model, but China in the 1980s was, you know, when you talk of the 1960s, that's kind of the equivalent, you know, of going from Flintstone era to, oh, say 1902 somewhere.
And you don't need to copy, and I want to get your thoughts on this. You don't need to take the whole country to the 1960s. There's certain areas that you can, and that's what's happened in China. My friends that have traveled there with congressional delegations and things like that have said, you know, when you get outside of the major cities, literally you go back hundreds of years, and you don't even have to be that far out. And they have, the Chinese, you know, are way more focused on themselves internally. Now, this is a few years ago, than they are focused on external threats, because they have a very diverse population, and not all of them are enamored with the central government. And so even what I have to improve, I don't need to improve the lot of the whole nation, but maybe just my larger cities, I can improve them, and maybe we could migrate away from human feces in agriculture. That might be a noble cause, and good for everybody's health. But I don't need for all boats to rise. I just need for a significant number of boats to rise, and then everybody will be happy.
Well, the point's well taken, and because the question is scale, and
right.
North Korea is not that big a population. In fact, compared to China, it's tiny. And so it's always easier to change or improve things in a smaller place. And once again, that's partly one of the reasons Singapore's been so successful, is it only had 5 million people. So it's easier to effect change. And same with, as you've noted, with North Korea, that, you know, you don't have to, it's an easier challenge to sort of improve things with that smaller place and a place that's that far behind. Where it really is, once you get out of the cities, it's reportedly, as you've described it, you know, people using, you know, feces, crap to fertilize. But there is a sense, and you do get, how'd you call it, in the border areas where you have North Korean traders and now and then something approaching sort of free, sort of these street markets, that they know the game, and if there is any sort of easing up, that you'll see that a certain amount of industriousness magically appears, and that just improves things. And as you say, it raises the water level. And same thing happened with the Russians once the old Soviets allowed. It wasn't private ownership of communal property, agricultural property, but it was the right to, pretty much the right to use your land as you saw fit. And those parts of the Soviet agricultural system became immensely productive. The communally owned, state-owned parts stayed just terrible. But once you ease up a bit, you find the whatever it is, that productiveness in human nature just kind of kicks in. And particularly you see it in places like the cold parts of Asia, where if you're not productive in industriousness, you'll die, and that regardless of the regime. Not so much in, say, in Indonesia, where you just throw something in the ground and it grows. I don't think it's all that hard for Kim to, as you said, get out of the Flintstone era and get it into the 60s.
Interesting. All right, we have a few minutes left. I've got a couple emails, but I want to ask you something about the world order. This is going to be kind of a big, question and a little bit of an intellectual test for you. So, not that I mind doing that in front of God and everybody.
It's 5:30 in the morning.
Exactly. The world economic order is being shaken a bit, and the United States has negotiated it to where it is today. We have we insured everybody's defense. The American taxpayer has, and nations have gotten used to that. You know, Germany is indignant about having to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on defense. Why? What would we do? Why would we do that? It impacts our social programs. It might impact our infrastructure programs. What in God's name would we be doing that for? And so, now, part two of that is we have negotiated a series of economic agreements in which, in any way I would say that you would evaluate them, the United States is underwriting other economies by virtue of the trade deficits and access by American producers into those markets. What is your I'd be curious as somebody who does, you know, observes other governments interacting. What do you make of Donald Trump seemingly trying to get them to one in NATO, spend, and even the Japanese nudge them into spending for the collective defense, so that when we do push back on China, it is a legitimate shove. Yeah, you might not want to go there, dude. Instead of when we shove them, we're actually physically moved back. Okay? So we need you to have a strong defense for you. We also are very interested in getting away from us underwriting you and our lack of access to your markets. What do you make of Donald Trump and this kind of moving of the tectonic plates that have been in place for so long in terms of Americans underwriting other defense, other economies?
Taking the defense question first, I think Mr. Trump is right that our allies have not spent enough. And they've consciously done this, generally so they can ensure they have national dental plans, for which you can wait 6 months to see a dentist. Read something, just get on Google and type in like German defense readiness. And you read this stuff, and it's almost hilarious, right, to think that this is what's become of the Hun. They've got like no submarines that work, like something like 6 aircraft, maybe 100 tanks.
Maybe.
Yeah, I'm being generous here.
Being generous,
and they're doing this on purpose. Now, it's not as if it suddenly happened by accident, but you have German politicians, officials, defense ministers who consciously have disarmed the country. And yet they expect the Americans to be fully committed to everything America does that ultimately underwrites German defense. One thing I will say for the Germans is that they make the Japanese look really, really good. In terms, I criticize the Japanese a lot for what they do and don't do on defense, but boy, compared to the Germans, the Japanese are the best allies we could possibly have.
They look downright militaristic compared to the Germans.
Even the British, it's nothing wrong with the quality of British personnel, but once again, this is successive administrations, particularly conservative ones in Britain, that have effectively disarmed the country. And it's insane. And Mr. Trump has been correct to point this out. It's considered impolite and boorish behavior by our elite foreign policy and sort of the academic classes in America, but he's right. And sometimes countries do have to reconsider their defense position, reconsider alliances, and it's about time the Americans do this. And I would say this is actually regardless of administration. It's not because Mr. Trump has come in, but I think any administration should have done this. And one way to look at this is if you consider, what defense relationship, say, the British had or the Americans had in 1900. And then 75 years later, in 1900, it was pretty good, it made sense. But certainly you would think in 1975, it might be worth rethinking the alliances, the approach to international defense that America and Britain had in 1900. I think that's pretty obvious. And that's really what we're talking about now. But it's about time to have a re-look at this. It's not necessarily to say throw everything out, but just because we've done things for 75 years doesn't mean we should keep doing it. That's the defense part, and that's actually it's easier to my way of thinking. But the trade issue, where Mr. Trump is being considered or being criticized for trying to overthrow this global trading system, that's existed for a long while now, post-World War II pretty much. But what I would suggest, this is my take, and it's simplified down quite a lot, is that the problem is not with global trade, and I think Mr. Trump recognizes that, but rather it's with the rules. It's the way the rules have been applied, and particularly what has really thrown this out of whack to the point it is potentially fatal for us was allowing China into the World Trade Organization 20 years ago. That is largely responsible for really hollowing out American industry and giving the Chinese this huge economic advantage that they have used very effectively also politically. And so they were let in without being required to follow, to obey the rules of WTO. There's no nicer way to say this. The idea was that over time, they would, as their economy liberalized, the country would change into a more liberal, democratic place. Well, that didn't work out very well. And people are finally, I say the chattering class that blew it, they've all started to, many of them have started to realize this, but it's 20 years too late. So the problem is actually with the way the rules were applied, and not with the international trade itself. And what I might describe it to is, say you have a football game, and one side gets 12 points for every touchdown. They get to see what the other side's playbook looks like. They get a veto. They get to decide what the other team's lineup is going to be. And then they've also been bribing giving gifts to the NFL commissioner in his office, and who've gone along with all of this, and they've even held out the prospects of even more bribes. So your problem there is not with the game of football. It's not anything wrong with the forward pass or the end around, but rather it's the way the rules have been applied to the game. And that, I think, is the problem with the international trading system. But it was when China was allowed in, the scale is such that it has just distorted everything in a very dangerous way. Now, other people who deserve some credit for all of this is what one might call our CEO class, our MBA professionals, who have bought into all of this, thinking borders don't matter anymore, nationality doesn't matter, all that matters is cheap production.
Right.
And if you can get something made somewhere else cheaper, you create this magic thing called the supply chain. And the more global it is, the more complex it is, the smarter you feel. And they have been as complicit, I think, in trying to destroy or weaken the American economy, and I'd say the free world's economy, as has anything the PRC has done. I say as complicit, not less. Not more.
It's a part. It's certainly a partnership. Yes.
Been a willing partnership.
Right.
So that's sort of my take on both the defense angle and the international the trade angle as well. It's really a question with the defense. It's just this utter dependency on the United States, and if you've got the rich uncle who'll pull out $1,000 and give you, every time he comes to visit, well, why not have him keep doing that? At some point, hopefully, he wises up. But with the trade thing, to me, it very much is a question of how the rules are applied and have been applied. And then also throw in the willingness of U.S. diplomats and trade negotiators just to want to reach a deal and to accept deals which have had some real shortcomings. But you want to go home and look successful, and that means you've reached an agreement, you've had a closing ceremony, and, you, of course, have your government pension, and you don't, but someone else pays for it. And so there's been this thing is complex, but it's not that hard to get to the basics of it, I think. But fixing it, of course, is, that's why I just comment. I don't have to fix anything.
Well, we would fix it. We would fix it. We're fixers as Marines. There would be a few egg yolks on the floor, but it would get fixed, and then we would screw it up, and then we would unscrew it about two or three more times and evolve it into something that is acceptable. I have two email questions before I let you go. Can you come on tomorrow again, Grant?
Yeah, if you want.
Well, I'd be curious to get your comments on whatever happens tonight and whatever they announce tonight. So if you don't mind.
I'm wrong. Okay.
Okay. First email. Hey Mac. Uncharacteristically, very astute questions by you this morning. My compliments. Could you ask Grant to explain the military situation between mainland China and Taiwan? Is there any chance that mainland China could ever roll Taiwan? Grant?
Yes. If they wanted to do it now, they could. If there is an invasion, or say they were to launch an amphibious assault, you know, they could probably get some few tens of thousands ashore in the first day, even now.
Even now? That's 180 miles between the two countries.
I'm afraid they could probably do it. But keep in mind that an assault would be part of a much larger attack. With a missile assault on Taiwan that would hammer them, cyber attacks, communications would go down. You would have the submarine sinking any Taiwanese ships out in the water, both civilian and commercial. The Chinese Air Force would be out in force, eventually rendering the Taiwan Air Force extinct. And it would be this huge psychological blow. So you could slip in your amphibious force in that context.
Okay.
And so, yes, they could do that, but they don't. I think that's their fifth choice of two. I think the constant, steady subversion and strangulation of Taiwan is demoralizing for Taiwan citizens, even ones who want to be free. I want to stay as far away from mainland China as they can get. But, you know, when your economy hasn't done much for 10 years at least, you know, you're losing your diplomatic allies. The Chinese are threatening you, sailing ships around the island and flying aircraft around. Just this constant invective. There does seem to be a certain hopelessness which sets in amongst the Taiwanese population. And over time, this is debilitating, and you may find that I think China would prefer to just keep this up and have a later Taiwanese administration say, okay, let's work out some deal. We agree. We'll have a sort of special status within, the PRC. So militarily, they could actually do it. There would be a lot of kickback from the rest of the world, I think, which would not be helpful to China. The strangling them is well within is achievable. It's been ongoing for a long time, and the Americans successive administrations have not done anything near what they could to have bolstered Taiwan's position militarily, diplomatically, psychologically. It is really in a very dangerous position, very weak position now. It's not too late, but it's pretty late. It's eighth inning and you're down by about seven, with the baseball analogy.
There you go. All right. Next question. Mac, I have a question for Grant, if you wouldn't mind. When China begins to move in the East China Sea relative to Japan, what will we see there? Will we see them attempting to fortify coral reefs and other atolls? Will we see them land on some kind of small island and begin to fortify that? What will we see when that card begins to get played? And does Grant believe that that card will get played anytime soon?
Yeah, I think it's going to get played. It kind of already is being played. But the point, of course, is when are they really going to do it for keeps? I would suggest that they're going to wait and see if Abe gets reelected. If he is not reelected, I think then they're really going to start to push, because whoever replaces him is not going to have the same sense of the need for a decent defense as Abe does. But I think what it will look like is more Chinese ships in more places, more of the time. And this includes the fishing fleet, the so-called maritime militia, the Coast Guard, their fishing, fishery patrols, and the PLA, the actual Navy, in particular, their force. And I think you're just going to see more of them in more places so that they swarm, the Japanese and sort of through osmosis take over the place. And then at some point, when you put some guys on the Senkaku Islands, for example, and you tell the Japanese, look, they're just here to help maintain freedom of navigation. We have a lot of fishing boats out here. In case there's a problem, they can go out and rescue them.
Weather station. What else could we put out there?
That'll work. And this is Chinese territory. We've been saying it. We told you, Japanese, we gave you the opportunity to reach a decent agreement with us. You refused. Here we are. If you want to do something about it, well, have at it. And I think that's how it's perhaps most likely to play out. And once the Chinese have shaped the physical environment, the operational environment, and the psychological environment into their advantage, that would be my guess. And I think it's plausible, but then again, you could probably come up with several ways, but that I think is what I would consider the most likely development, that this long-term absorption of Japan's southernmost oceans and maybe a bit of the property too.
Okay. All right. Well, you know what, Grant, it's been interesting in sitting down and after role-playing and after you became Kim Jong Newsom. I honestly do see a blueprint for them. One, you have to understand that they don't look at current situations. They look at as far probably as dealing with Donald Trump, get him to go sideways till the next election. Then we'll put together, then it will be another phase of our 4-year plan, depending on who gets elected. The more gullible, the more we like it, because we can move their cheese very slowly. And nobody's going to demand that we move their cheese quickly. And that's what we have to guard against. And so I now see a road to a strategy that makes sense for North Korea. Getting their economy into the 1960s would be a huge win for him. He never gives up his nukes. He's elevated in stature around the world. And it's win-win-win for him. And the United States never gets what it wants. Never gets what it wants. So, but we could talk about it for about 20 years, and that's a good thing. So, there you have it. And ultimately, what I give up is I give up testing, which I can't do right now. I don't really need to shoot over Japan, so I can give that up as well. And I've given nothing up, but they feel so good about themselves, and my country's better off for it. So it's been fantastic. So. Interesting. Well, we'll see what comes out of this, and I'll shoot you an email later today. But I'd look forward to your comments on whatever happens this evening and whatever is announced later on today. So, thank you for getting up early.
Yes. Okay. Well, sounds good. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right. Thanks, Grant.
Bye, Tom. Mm-hmm.
That is the one and only Grant Newsham, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired. You can find his writing in Asia Times. All you have to do is Google it. Newsham, first name Grant, and you'll see his stuff pop up all over the place. So, with all of that said, we'll take a quick break. Michael Musselman will join us next. More of All Marine Radio on a Monday coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.